case number 74335, the State of Nevada Department of Business and Industry Financial Institutions Division versus TitleMex of Nevada, Inc., DBA TitleBucks, DBA TitleMex, Delaware Corporation. We have Ms. Stern representing the appellant, Mr. Paulsenberger representing the respondent. Ms. Stern, you wish to proceed?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I would like to try to do that, yes.
Okay, and you'll see it, Justices Silver and Kadish are participating by video from Las Vegas. Also, Justice Stiglitz is not here, but she is watching this live on the Internet, and she will be participating in the resolution of this case.
Thank you, Your Honor. The purpose of the law at issue in this case, NRS Chapter 604A, is to protect consumers from predatory lending. As this court has previously noted, excuse me, it's to keep consumers off of the debt treadmill that can result when they take out short-term loans. It is not to help the lender collect more interest from the consumer. To reach the conclusion advocated by TitleMax in this case requires contorting the plain language of Chapter 604A, as well as disregarding its very purpose. The district court was only able to reach this result by refusing to allow the word additional to mean more and the word gratuitous to mean free of charge. The absurd result reached in this case must be reversed. I'll start with Section 445. There's a dispute among the parties as to whether 445 governs in this case, and it's the State of Nevada's position that it absolutely does. 445 governs all title loans and serves the purpose of protecting consumers. TitleMax even tells the consumers when they take out this new loan product that's at issue here, that it is a modification or an amendment of the original loan. The time period imposed by 445 thus applies. It's a time period of 210 days, the very most. The reason for this limit is directly connected to the purpose of this statute. It is to protect consumers from getting on a debt treadmill where their interest owed and payments owed extend well beyond 210 days. The result of this limit is that it bars the lender from charging more interest than would accrue over 210 days of ratably and fully amortized interest. It protects the borrower by ensuring that the lender considers their ability to repay during 210 days and doesn't disregard that and thereby stretch the loan payment period beyond that limit. The loan payment plan offered here by TitleMax directly subverts these limits, both the plain language of 445 and the purpose of the statute. The next important question in this case that this court must address is whether the TitleMax loan payment plan offered to consumers is a grace period under the statute. It absolutely is not. Not only is it not a compliant 210-day loan, it does not comply with any part of the statute. It doesn't comply with 445, it doesn't comply with Section 0.0, and it doesn't comply with Section 210. It violates Section 070 because it is not gratuitous. It's not free of charge. Neither under the common sense definition of gratuitous or the statutory meaning does this loan product fit what is understood as a grace period. This court must not redefine gratuitous to mean only that the lender does not impose certain additional fees or that the lender does not impose certain rate of interest. That's not in the statute. What gratuitous means is free of charge, and this plainly is not. The consumer, if you look at our brief, we include some tables. One of them is right at page 2, where we set out an example loan under this loan product, and it's quite clear when you actually look at the numbers that the consumer is paying more. They are paying more interest to the lender. TitleMax is benefiting. That's not gratuitous. I will also note that in TitleMax's brief, they studiously avoid showing the court any of those numbers. And there's a reason for that, because it becomes plain when you look at those numbers that this was not free of charge. In addition,
so, counsel, what did it mean when the statute was proposed to say that there could be no, could not charge any fees or interest, and changed it to no additional fees or interest?
Sure. Any in that context could have been read to mean that the lender could not collect interest that had already accrued on the loan. In other words, we accept that interest is going to accrue on the loan. It just has to be limited to whatever would be fully amortized within the 210 days. If a grace period is offered, the lender can still collect that interest under the language at issue here. What it bars is additional interest, meaning more. If the consumer has to pay more interest, then it's not a grace period. It's not free of charge. So one more thing I wanted to say about that is, with the going back to the purpose of the statute, this court has said that statutes with a protective purpose, like this one, must be liberally construed to effectuate the benefits intended to be obtained. If this is truly a protective statute, it's meant to decrease the consumer's burden, not increase it. Interpreting this statute in the way that Title Max claims and asks for would result in increasing the consumer burden and would go directly contrary to the way this court has said it will interpret protective statutes. Misdefining this product as a grace period violates the plain language across the board of this entire statute, and it allows Title Max to add an additional loan term, or an illegal extension, as the ALJ found, to the original loan term. One comment with regard to the amendment that was made to the statute in 2017, it's not applicable here, but Title Max does use that amendment to try and argue that the addition of the word rate in that amendment was a clarification of what this means. And I would just invite the court to look at all of the changes made to that subsection in that 2017 amendment. Clearly was not just a clarification. It restructured that entire amendment to provide additional consumer protections, not to take them away. Finally, Title Max's behavior was willful. Willfulness is a fact-sensitive determination, and this court owes deference to the factual determinations made by the ALJ, particularly those here that implicate willfulness. The district court erred in not applying any deference to the ALJ's finding as to what went on during the time period in which Title Max was hearing what the FID told them about their compliance with the statute, but not complying, and in fact not taking any action to remedy what they were doing in order to comply with the statute. I would draw this court's attention to the definition of willfulness that this court adopted in Century Steel, which is cited in our brief. Once again, we're just looking at the plain language. What does willfulness mean? This court says it means intentional, deliberate, knowing, and voluntary. In other words, it doesn't mean accidental. In this case, we have pretty clear factual findings from the ALJ that Title Max was indifferent to the statutory requirements. It was indifferent to the interpretation of the state regulator, and it acted contrary to that advice and to that sanction that the FID gave it. I would invite this court.
So is there any circumstance where they could have a good faith dispute with the agency about the interpretation of the statute that would not be a willful violation then?
I think so, Your Honor. And I would actually draw your attention to the cases of Bay State and Safeco, which are both cited in the briefing. And those cases pretty much distinguish what it means to have a good faith dispute versus what it means to be willfully violating. And the difference in both cases is that if you received instruction from the agency that is supposed to implement and protect under the law, that means if you act in contrary to that afterwards, you are acting willfully because you're acting knowingly. Now, Bay State, it defines knowing as you received advice from the agency contrary to what you're doing, then you acted knowingly. Safeco, similarly, found that there was no willfulness because there was no agency advice on the issue. Here, as the ALJ found, we have agency advice on the issue. Not once, not twice, multiple times.
Did you advise specifically as to what the violation was?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Tell me how. And what context?
The two best examples, I think, are the two audits that were done. The first audit finding a needs improvement, and the second audit finding unsatisfactory. As well, the ALJ, in the timeline that it lays out, talks about the various conversations that the FID had with Title Max during that same period of time.
Those were specifically related to gratuitous, whether it was gratuitous and whether it was an extension?
Yes, and that's in the transcript, I believe, that the examiners talk about what they found the violations were.
So that was a document that was sent to them that they had?
I believe it was a document. I don't exactly know the form, but it was conversations as well as a document. I don't know if the document laid out in a legal briefing type of way. In answer to your question, I don't know that.
Who were the conversations with?
The examiners and the representatives from Title Max, as well as, I'll say as well, counsel at the Attorney General's office advised FID on this.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. So, finally, I would say that this court should give deference to the ALJ's findings. It made findings about Title Max's knowledge through its interactions, and these demonstrate willful violation of this statute. This court's precedent, Supreme Court precedent, and any common sense understanding of the word willful leads to only one result. The Title Max's behavior here was willful, and pursuant to the statute, Section 900, restitution is the only acceptable result here. A simple fine of $50,000, not sufficient, both to punish Title Max for its willful behavior, as well as, more importantly, what the FID really wants here, which is to restore consumers and protect consumers from what happened to them as a result of Title Max's behavior. The district court twisted the plain language of the statute beyond recognition, and it undermined the consumer protections that it was designed to provide to Nevadans. Its decision is owed no deference, and it must be reversed. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Reiner, Mr. Polsman is going to argue. That's what we're advised. I want to make sure I didn't inadvertently not announce you. Mr. Polsenberg.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Gibbons. May it please the court, Dan Polsenberg for the respondent, Title Max. The state is coming in here today and asking for a sanction that they estimate at nearly $40 million for the willful violation of a statute. But they're looking at the wrong statute. Throughout the case, they have been relying on NRS 604A.445, and that was their position in front of the administrative law judge, the district court, and the briefing in front of this court. That's not the statute. As the district court made clear, that statute doesn't talk about grace periods at all. In this case, it's all about grace periods. So
isn't that the question, whether in fact it is a grace period versus an extension or something else?
I think the question, Justice Kadish, is this a grace period? If it's not a grace period, then we don't comply with the statute. And the NRS, Justice Kadish and Justice Silver, I've arranged for a handout for subsection 210 here. I've tried to arrange for it down in Las Vegas. And in Carson City.
We have some.
Thank you. In Carson City, we also have a blowout. So here are the requirements for a grace period under the statute. And the legislature set this out in 2005. And here's what you need. First of all, there are two exceptions. You can't charge any fee for granting a grace period, and everybody agrees we didn't. And you can't charge any additional fees or additional interest on the outstanding loan during the grace period. And so the question is, can we charge interest at all during a grace period? The FID admits in the evidentiary hearing in front of the administrative law judge, the grace period can be any time. So the only question is, can we charge interest? If you look at the statutory language, and the district court said there'd be no reason for the word additional interest if it was a prohibition of interest entirely? So what do we mean by additional interest? You know, both sides are using interest as a noun modifying another noun. Throughout my brief, I keep saying interest rate. Throughout the state's brief, they say interest amount or interest charge or amount of interest. So which one is it? We've got an ambiguity here. Both sides are arguing an interpretation. If you look at the statutory history from 2005, it is clear that the original version of the statute was proposed as saying you cannot charge any interest, and the legislature changed it to additional interest. So the language change would make it clear that we're allowed to charge interest, just not at a higher rate. And there are more indications that I'm right on this interpretation. In 2012, the FID had a workshop to propose regulations. They admitted the statute was ambiguous and it could mean either of these two things. They proposed a regulation that said you can't charge any interest at all. The lending industry proposed a regulation that said you can charge interest, but not at a higher rate. No regulation was adopted. And in 2017, Your Honor? Sorry, I thought somebody asked a question.
That was me copying. Excuse me. Sorry.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. In 2017, the legislature amended NRS subsection 210, and it clarified. In one page alone of the reply brief, the FID says that this is clarification. And it says you can charge interest, but not at a rate higher than the contractual interest. So all this leads to our conclusion, you can charge interest, just not at a rate higher than the contractual amount. So I think we're right on all.
In what sense is it gratuitous if you're charging more interest than you would have under the 7-month amortized loan?
Well, gratuitous, although subsection 070 says gratuitous, it says a grace period means a period of deferment offered gratuitously if the licensee complies with the provisions of 604A210. And I would say that gratuitously is defined by the two provisions in 210. It says, first of all, you can't charge a fee for granting grace period, and you cannot charge any additional fees or additional interest. So gratuitously means you can't charge a fee, you can't charge any other types of fees, such as late fees. Remember, if you look at the legislative history from 210, what the legislature was concerned about were the things that lenders back then were doing. If you got to a point where you were late, you had late fees, you had 2% per day that you were late, they would bump up the interest 3 times because you were late. This is what the legislature wanted to get rid of. So gratuitously is defined by the requirements in 210, and section 070 even says that, as long as the licensee complies with the provisions of 210. So I don't think 210 says...
What's the point of requiring it to only be no more than a 7-month fully amortized principal and interest payments loan and turn it into a 14-month interest then principal with more interest than would otherwise be allowed? I mean, what's the point then?
Justice Kadish, the district judge made that clear in the, and I think it's a great opinion, and it's about the third the size of our opening brief. 445 subsection 3 sets out the requirements for the original term, and then any grace period is an exception to the original term. So 210 and 070, 210 says the provisions of this chapter do not prohibit a licensee from offering a customer a grace period. So 445, another provision in the chapter, can't overrule 210, which is an exception to that. Now, let's assume I'm wrong on the meaning of the grace period. Then the question is, should we have, remember, the administrative law judge imposed 2 sanctions here. One was $1,000 a case for the 307 cases there, coming to 307,000. She reduced it to 50,000 as long as we kept our noses clean. And in addition to the $50,000, said we had to return under Section 900, had to return all the interest, principals, finance charges, and everything else. Again, they estimated that to be $39.5 million. But willfulness has to mean more than just strict liability, which is their approach. If you intentionally do an act, even if you think it is compliant with the statutes, they say we should get the we should have the penalty. But I think under the circumstances, we were reasonable in believing that we complied with the statute. We didn't intentionally violate the statute. We thought we were complying. I think we're complying. The district judge thought we were complying.
Mr. Polsenberg,
why did you wait?
Point,
oh, sorry.
This is Gabby. Going back to my earlier point, you were told that you weren't complying with the statute. And they said there were conversations that said specifically why you weren't complying with the statute.
No, let me lay out what the facts, because what the administrative law judge said is in the December 2014 examination return, we were then on notice that we were not in compliance with the statute. What happened was we got the return of their annual exam on December 18th, 2014. We sent a letter February 9th, 2015, and we said, we think we are. It was a 10-page letter. Pat sent it. It was single-spaced. Most of it had to do with this issue. There was another issue as well having to do with whether you could have guarantors for title loans. We asked for their response. On March 2nd, we got a non-response. They said, we stand by our position. So they never laid out their legal argument for why they thought we were in violation. Their determination in December was by lay examiners. And those people testified that they thought we were in violation of 445. And what we are pointing out is under 210 and 070, we have arguments for why this, we think this is a grace period. In June 1st, we filed a declaratory relief action trying to get the determination. I think that alone is indication that we are in good faith here. We tried to get a legal determination. They moved to dismiss our declaratory relief action, say we hadn't exhausted administrative remedies. This court reversed and said it's a pure issue of law, what Section 210 means. So we would have had a determination back then, but they tried to avoid a determination. They moved to dismiss our claim on October 6th, the same day they filed the administrative complaint. Now, we stopped doing this in December of 2015, but the administrative law judge said when we heard from the lay examiners that we should have realized that we were wrong. Well, first of all, I don't think we're wrong. And secondly, we have a good faith basis for going ahead and doing what it is that we did. And I think that precludes any of the penalties that we're talking about here. I think the other indications that we're reasonable are, let me stick with that one. We disagreed with the government's determination. The district court, at the end of its order, discussed the Henson case from the United States Supreme Court and had a section, first of all, before that saying, you can disagree with the government on what the law is. You're not willfully violating a statute because you're saying your interpretation is incorrect. In fact, the other issue that I mentioned, whether you can have a guarantor and a title loan, they told us we were wrong on that, and even the administrative law judge ruled in our favor. So under these circumstances, I think we had a reasonable approach. We shouldn't have sanctions of this magnitude. Let me also say, the district judge thought it was an important factor for vacating sanctions that we had advice of counsel. Our advice of counsel went even further than my interpretation today. One of the justices asked a question about, here we have periods with, Justice Kedish said, we've got periods with interest only and periods with principal only. Our attorneys decided it would comply with the statute if we had charged no interest at all after the first 210 days. we're making, that reduces the effect of APR. We're, if we were really doing this just to make more money, we wouldn't have done that. We would charge a higher interest rate across the board at the very beginning. Council started the argument by talking about the purpose of 604A, and the U.S. Supreme Court has also made clear in the cases cited by the district court that the purpose of a statutory scheme cannot overrule the exact wording of a particular statute. So they can't come in here and say, look, we're all about the debt treadmill, and this is wrong, because this statute says what is part of that statutory scheme. And besides, look at what we were doing. And our people testified, too. We were trying to find a way to get flexibility to title lenders, title borrowers. Remember, this is a non-recourse loan. This isn't the type of debt treadmill we see in the 2005 and 2017 legislative histories, where they're talking about payday lenders who take, the borrowers take out loans and can't repay them and have to get another loan to pay the interest on the first loan, and then a third loan. The 2017 record talks about how some of them are going to three different borrowers to try to pay off all the interest. That wasn't the case here. We didn't charge interest in the second 210 days. The payments...
No, but you charged 50% more interest in the first 210 days, right?
Which, honestly, 153%, which, first of all, that was just, that was just an offer, Judge. This was not the situation, under the current statute, you don't have to even modify the contract. We made this available. We could have done it by a letter and said, look, if you want to take more time to pay, you can take more time, but interest will continue to run. If Pat came to me right now and said, I want to take out a loan, I give him a 210-day loan. He comes to me before the first payment and says, can you give me a 7-month grace period on all the payments? I could have said, sure. You're going to owe more interest because interest runs under 210 during the grace period.
You said something.
So you're going to owe more interest.
No, Judge.
Sorry, go ahead.
We disagree on what the word interest means. They say a greater interest amount. I say the statute means a greater interest rate.
Well, that's where I want to ask you, correct me if I'm wrong, the first 210-day loan was operating under 133% interest, and you just said it was 153.
No. The amount of interest in some circumstances, they set out the Esguerra case where somebody did take advantage of all this. Realize, you don't have any testimony from any borrowers complaining about this because that gave them flexibility to avoid default. That's what the whole point of this was. The effective annual, in that case, the Esguerra case that they bring up in their brief, the APR, if they took 210 days, was 133%. If they took the 420 days, the effective APR was only 97%.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chief
Justice.
Justice
Hardesty has a question.
Thank you, Justice Hardesty.
Mr. Paulsenberg, you've indicated that the state focused on rate or amount, and you focused on the other.
Other way around. They did amount, I did rate.
And I'm focused on any, which says to me that the licensee shall not charge the customer any additional interest. Why doesn't that language encompass both of your points and prohibit any additional interest? Whether it's calculated by rate or whether it's calculated by added amount, original loan, it says any.
Well, the original version said any fee or any interest, and they charged the legislature changed the any interest to additional interest. And then I think it is even FID in their rulemaking capacity admitted that it was unclear what additional interest means. The district court said if it meant you can't charge interest during the grace period, the word additional wouldn't be necessary at all.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Paulsenberg. Ms. Stern, you have about a little over 3 minutes.
Just a couple of things. I think it's fair to say that Title Max's attempt to fit its product into the definition of grace period has developed over time. But I would like to draw this court's attention back to what was going on when the FID found it noncompliant, which is the FID specifically pointed out to Title Max that they were in violation of 0.445. That's really all that was required at that point. It's really Title Max's job to somehow explain how it fits into the grace period and takes it out of 445 somehow. They have failed to do that. And just as an example of the absurdity of the result reached here by the district court, I wanted to invite the court to think about this grace period and ask yourselves, which part of this product is the grace period? If the whole thing is a grace period, what happened to the original term of the loan? If the first half of this product is the grace period, there's no principal paid down during that period. So how is that somehow a free ability to pay down your loan? You're not paying any principal during that period. If the last half of this product is the grace period, it's not much of a grace period if you've already paid all of the interest and additional interest that Title Max decided to collect on the full principal amount of the loan. So if there aren't any further questions, that's all I have.
Quick questions from Justice Kadish.
Is your position then that any additional amount of interest over and above that shown, let's just call it in the TWID disclosure, anything over and above that would render it not capable of complying with the grace period statutes?
I believe so, Your Honor. I'll just say it a little more specifically, which is the consumer should only pay the ratably and fully amortized interest that accrues over 210 days.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Stern. Thank you for your excellent arguments and briefs, and we will take this case under